The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the Henry Luce Foundation for Increased Understanding of East and Southeast Asia. Funding for Detroit coverage on The Takeaway is supported in part by the W.K. Kellogg Foundation.
So world headlines are dominated by this G20 summit going on in Cannes right now. We expect an emergency meeting of the Greek government to actually determine what they're going to be talking about at this summit of world leaders. Greece is not even a member of the G20. And one of the consequences of the 2007 global financial crisis, something that we're seeing even today, has been to accelerate a shift away from the traditional 19th and 20th century industrial powers and toward a new emerging center of economic power in the world. The debt-heavy and slow-growth economies of Europe and the USA are now dependent on investments and exports from the emerging economies of the so-called BRIC nations, Brazil, Russia, India, and China. And that shift is certainly reflected in the influence China and India in particular are having right now at the G20 summit in Cannes. So it's clearer than ever that the U.S. is no longer the grand mediator in global affairs. The era of the single superpower ushered in at the end of the Cold War in 1989 seems to be over. And a short era it was. Something's afoot here. Joining us now is famed historian Neil Ferguson, professor at Harvard Business School and author of the new book published just this week, Civilization, the West and the Rest. Neil Ferguson, good morning.
Very good to be with you.
Oh, and it's a great Skype connection you have there. It's great to talk to you again. Congratulations on this book. And with the context of the 600 years of history that you chronicle in this book, give me your impressions of the drama playing out in Cannes and the frustration of world leaders from the current set of empires confronting a tempest in a teapot in Athens and the unraveling, apparently, of the Greek government.
Well, it's richly ironic, isn't it, that this crisis should have as its epicenter the country that we think of as the cradle of Western civilization, Greece. And really, it's rather tragic that the sort of self-destruction of the Greek government that we're witnessing at the moment has the potential to turn what you rightly call a storm in a teacup into a really huge financial tsunami. The worry is, of course, that what is happening right now is moving the world economy close to the edge of a second phase of financial crisis. Much has happened in the early 1930s when the failure of a big Austrian bank called Credit Anstalt in effect ushered in the second phase of the Depression, the thing that really made the Depression great. So the stakes are enormously high here. And I think rather as in the interwar period, no one is quite in charge. If you think back to one of the classic accounts of the Great Depression, Charles Kindleberger's, one of the arguments he made was that there was a kind of problem of divided hegemony because the United States had sort of taken over financially from Britain during the First World War, but wasn't really ready to play the dominant role that Britain had played in the world before 1914.
So Neil, that sounds exactly like the role of China right now.
Right,
that's fascinating.
So the analogy is pretty good. The Chinese have become, really in the space of 30 years, the second great giant in the world economy. They actually, by one measure, will overtake the United States in terms of gross domestic product as soon as 2016. And yet the Chinese are very hesitant about playing the kind of role that they're now entitled to play by sheer economic weight. There's been a lot of talk over the last few weeks and months about China somehow bailing Europe out. There was a rather symbolic moment when the guy running the European Financial Stability Fund went scuttling off to Beijing with his cap in hand, asking the Chinese to stump up some cash for Europe. But the Chinese, although they talk about doing this, are very hesitant to commit resources. They're very risk averse, in fact, because they remember how they lost money trying to invest in Morgan Stanley in the American phase of the financial crisis a few years ago. So we are in one of the times of, I think, transition. The United States is clearly a far less self-confident power than it was under George W. Bush, driving from the back seat during the Libyan crisis. Meanwhile, China is not, I think, quite ready for prime time. And that's a very bad situation, it seems to me. And I fear this G20 summit will illustrate perfectly that, well, no one's in charge in terms of global leadership right now.
Neil Ferguson is our guest. He's a professor of history at Harvard University. He's the author of Civilization, the West and the Rest. That book is published just this week. And it's a very interesting sort of underscore of everything we've been talking about here. You know, in the conclusion of your book, you describe that and there are many precedents for this in history, when great empires or great sort of industrial cartels or industrial sort of allegiances go, sometimes it happens very, very quickly. Taking this sort of leadership vacuum that you've just described and coupling that with some of the built-in kind of bottlenecks that exist in the way the Eurozone is constructed, do you see something sort of, you know, very complex and kind of rapid fire happening here, possibly, that in 5 years we could see a world that, you know, has really challenged the pre-existing national order in some way?
Yes, I think we have to understand a very, very important thing about the way history works that I don't think is generally recognized. We tend to think that big things, big man-made entities like empires or civilizations, and my book's really focusing on the idea of civilization, rise, they reach a sort of zenith, and then they gently decline into old age, rather as you and I do. But it's not quite like that. In fact, these big complex political and economic entities like civilizations or empires have a tendency to grow very rapidly, reach a kind of peak, and then sort of hover there in what looks like equilibrium. And quite suddenly, without much warning, they collapse. And it's this sudden collapse scenario that fascinates me, because one comes across it again and again when you go right the way back to the first incarnation of Western civilization. The Roman Empire falls apart very much more suddenly than the traditional accounts would have you believe. And each time I was looking at what went wrong with other civilizations as the West rose again after around 1500, I was hit by how fast things fell apart, whether it's Ming China in the 17th century, or for that matter, the Incas in Peru, or later on, the Ottoman Empire. Things have a way of falling apart. This, I guess, I picked up from doing work on financial history, which was what produced my last book, The Ascent of Money. But it, you know, it doesn't just apply to financial markets.
No, it's chilling. It applies to political orders as well. And the incremental scenario is really the Byzantines, the last ones that actually put that one together. Neil Ferguson is our guest. He's going to stay with us. He's a professor of history at Harvard University, author of Civilization, the West and the Rest. So, Neil, I wanted to ask you about this 25-nation poll by our partner, the BBC. Did you happen to see it?
You got me there.
All right, that's okay. I can give you the numbers, but it relates directly to what you were just talking about a moment ago. We've talked a lot about governments and what drives their sort of collapse or a precipitous rise. The BBC reported this week that people in the industrial world are overwhelmingly pessimistic about their immediate future, while emerging economies are, by contrast, in something of a party mood of optimism. The Chinese, 51% optimists, not terribly surprising. Same with the Indians and the Brazilians. The Egyptians, 57%. Neil, check this out. Nigerians, more than 70% are optimistic about the future. Meanwhile, Japan, Australia, France, in the single digits. USA, only 16%. Even the Germans can only muster 36% of people with a positive outlook on the future. How does that drive economies, do you think?
But it certainly plays a very important part. John Maynard Keynes said that one of the key drivers of economic growth was animal spirits. Confidence is another word for it. The more work that we do on behavioral psychology and try to apply that work to the field of economics, the more obvious it becomes that there are close links between our state of mind and our economic behavior, our economic activity. The term depression is not coincidentally a term that economics borrowed from psychology. And it was first used in the 1870s and then again in the 1930s to characterize a period of protracted low growth and even negative growth and high unemployment. And I think it's relevant today, in the sense that although we're not in a Great Depression, I do think large parts of the Western world are in a depression. It might be a slight depression, but it's certainly not a recession of the sort that we got used to in the post-war period, something that was fairly short and sharp. So I think what we're seeing here is a pretty accurate reflection of the divergent moods in a two-speed world. It is a two-speed world. The atmosphere of economic depression exists in mainly developed economies, whereas in the big emerging markets that you've been mentioning, from China down India through Brazil, not forgetting places like Indonesia and big African economies like Nigeria,
in fact,
the economic growth rate is higher than we've seen at any point in these countries' history. So it's really not surprising that people are feeling bullish.
And the consequences of that, of course, would you expect the pessimists to be the entrepreneurs in the 21st century, or would you expect the optimists to be that? I'm looking at your book now on page 305. It's actually one of the most remarkable conclusions that actually comes through the whole book. You say that the West dominated for so long because it had what you call six killer apps that the rest of the world lacked. Competition, the scientific revolution, the rule of law and representative government, modern medicine, the consumer society, and the work ethic, that those six killer apps gave the West its dominance. Is the East acquiring those apps responsible for its dominant, or do they have their own apps?
I think they've downloaded our apps, to put it in my perhaps somewhat labored computing metaphor. The different institutions and ideas that propelled the West into a position of such amazing economic and political dominance from around 1500 to the 1970s were kind of open source. You could download them if you just went and looked at the way things were done in the West. And gradually, beginning with Japan, non-Western societies did this. Japan got started early in the late 19th century in the Meiji era, but most of the big non-Western economies took time to catch on, and it was only really from the 1970s, beginning, I guess, with the Chinese reforms of Deng Xiaoping, that the most populous countries in the world downloaded our apps. Now, this image of downloading apps may irk some of your listeners, but it's a way of making a rather complex process of institutional transformation readily intelligible to our modern understanding.
No, I buy it completely, and it separates out the cultural element that the apps, like the technology and the Industrial Revolution, apply in every country. You can acquire them, and you can't project authorship of the Industrial Revolution any more than the Brits could project that they were an industrial power after the U.S. took over. But once you achieve that fluency in industry and the economy and all these apps you're talking about, then your cultural projection becomes very powerful, and that's where the Chinese stand.
That's right, and don't they know it? I mean, one of the interesting things to me is the way that the Chinese have very consciously learnt from Western history about everything from the importance of sea power to the dangers of unregulated financial markets. So I think this is quite a good way of thinking about it. The other point to notice is that if you buy my argument, it also gets rid of some bad arguments. There are lots of theories about why the West became so much richer and more powerful than the rest. Geography, for example, cultural difference often used to be cited, and there was a time when people would offer racial explanations for this. And these theories can all be jettisoned. From my point of view, the operating system isn't really the key. Whether you're a Confucian operating system or a Christian one, if you download these killer apps, people's behavior will change, their incentives will change, and very, very quickly you'll see a dramatic improvement in economic performance. And I think that's pretty well illustrated by what's happening. These particular institutions and ideas that I call the killer apps work anywhere. It doesn't matter about your geography or your traditional culture or the color of your skin. They will transform the behavior of citizens.
Neil, I've got an assignment for you. Why don't you send an app over there to the G20 summit for resolving the political crisis in Greece? You got one of those?
Well, I guess this would be my Learn from History app, which unfortunately not many Western leaders appear to have downloaded into their heads yet.
Well, you can make a start by getting the book Civilization, the West and the Rest. Neil Ferguson is a professor of history at Harvard University and a professor at the Harvard Business School. Neil, thanks as always.
My pleasure.
Weigh in on this, 877-8-MY-TAKE, or post a comment to thetakeaway.org.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.